On this week's 51%, we hear about how technology is helping to combat sexual assault.
So already using the app and their education, it's breaking taboos.
We then travel to the Yucatan to learn about Indigenous women and childbirth, and a women's choir sings without a director, by choice. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Thought I wasn't enough, found I wasn't so tough, laying on the bathroom floor. We were living on a foul line, and I felt the fault was all mine. Couldn't take it anymore.
College students are back in school, and over the past couple of years, governmental leaders and victims have increasingly called attention to sexual assault on campuses across the country. Using a pilot program at a college in Massachusetts, one company is working to combat the issue with technology. 51%'s Jim Lavoulis reports.
Last September, the White House launched the It's On Us public awareness campaign aimed at preventing sexual assault on campuses nationwide. During a press conference at the White House, President Obama said 1 in 5 women are sexually assaulted during their college years, yet only 12% of attacks are reported. He said men who are assaulted are even less likely to speak out.
This is not your fight alone. This is on all of us, every one of us, to fight campus sexual assault. You are not alone, and we have your back, and we are going to organize campus by campus, city by city, state by state. This entire country is going to make sure that we understand what this is about and that we're going to put a stop to it.
A technology called Circle of Six won a 2011 White House and Health and Human Services Apps Against Abuse Challenge. It works like this. You pick 6 people you trust from your contact list to form your circle, and with 2 taps, one to activate the app and another to send a message, an alert is sent to everyone in your circle.
The app is embedded with pre-programmed messages, easy user functionality, and the messages are, come and get me, I need help, and sends your GPS location to your circle, call and interrupt me. I need to get out of this situation. I need to talk is another one.
Nancy Schwartzman is the company's CEO. The app also has hotlines for relationship abuse, sexual assault, and mental health.
The app's user interface is very simple and social looking. So nothing about it when you pull it out looks like danger, alert, or anything like that.
The app was piloted last year at Williams College, which has about 2,100 students. A unique version tailored for the school was downloaded more than 2,700 times in its first year, according to Williams. University versions contain campus safety and other local resources featuring the school's logo and colors.
Schools can hinge all of their programming. They can use Circle of Six to talk about sexual assault and intimate partner violence and accountability and community in a really non-threatening way. They can do programs around it and then remind everyone to download it. They can train all of their resident advisors to know how to use Circle of Six and make them all have their entire floor download it when they arrive. They can check up in a month or two. Hey, guys, are you still using Circle of Six? Have you updated your circle? Do you need me to be in it?
Last year, a former Williams student who says she was sexually assaulted by a member of the men's hockey team in 2012 accused the school's leaders of mishandling her case. Media outlets covered the incident after the woman and her family complained that the alleged attacker was suspended but not expelled. Data from Circle of Six shows the app was opened an average of 134 times a day in the Williams community. In a survey addressing the same bystander behaviors encouraged by the app, 52% of 1,300 respondents at Williams said they interrupted a conversation when one person appeared to be making another feel unsafe or uncomfortable.
So already using the app and their education, it's breaking taboos. So we have incredible users, and really what it's showing is a behavior change that, okay, we're going to talk about this, and this is a collective solution because this is a community problem.
The app is also active at UCLA along with Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Schwartzman says it will launch at University of Houston and an 80,000-student high school system in Virginia in October. Overall, there are more than 300,000 users, mostly in the U.S., but spanning 36 countries. She says the Air Force Academy recommends it for its cadets. There are 80,000 users of a Hindi version in New Delhi, India, which was launched after the 2012 gang rape and murder of a young woman that made international news. Schwartzman says the app is designed as a prevention tool.
We want the app to be in use sort of right at the beginning of a situation. So it's late tonight and I'm leaving a party and I don't see my friends, or I've been studying late at the library. I don't want someone to have to make a choice that's not ideal. Like, do I cross campus at 3 o'clock in the morning by myself? Do I stay at this party and hope someone will walk me home?
For 51%, I'm Jim Lavoulis.
In Mexico, an indigenous woman is 3 times more likely to die during childbirth or postpartum than a non-indigenous woman. Both culture and government policies play a role in the outcome. Reporter Jasmine Lopez went to the Yucatan to find out more.
In the center of the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, the sun is rising for what will be another humid 90-degree day in Xanlá. Xanlá is a rural Maya pueblo in the municipality of Chancón. Here is where you'll find Ney Amparo Sime Arceo's home.
Voy a desgranarlo.
I'm going to remove the corn kernels from the cob. They've been picked at. That's why I'm choosing the good ones.
Ney sits on a hammock in her kitchen and scrapes kernels from a corn cob. The kitchen is a traditional Mayan house, an oblong structure with a stone foundation, reeds, and a thatched roof. As Ney removes the kernels to ground into dough, she sits on a hammock exactly where she gave birth to most of her children.
When I had my first daughter, she was born in my mother-in-law's house. I lived in my mother-in-law's house for 3 years. Later, I got this house, and I had the rest of my children here, minus the youngest daughter.
Ney had 5 children in her home with the help of her partera, a midwife. Traditional Mayan midwifery dates back several centuries, but that tradition is being challenged.
In the past, it wasn't like it is today. We'd feel the pain and the midwife would examine you and tell you if it was almost time. When we would give birth here, my sister-in-law, my mother-in-law, my mother, and the midwife would come together to welcome the child. In the hospitals, it's very difficult. Over there, you're just laying in the bed. The doctors are gone attending others. Here you have your mom, your family.
Pregnant women that receive economic support from government programs such as Prospera are required to seek attention in government health clinics. Many midwives aren't recognized or respected by medical staff in hospitals and are forbidden from assisting women unless they're trained and certified. But that isn't easy.
Five of my children were with a midwife, just the last girl I had in the hospital. My midwife helped at the start, but the doctor said that I was at high risk because of my age. I was 43 when I was going to give birth to the girl. When the midwife was gathering her things for the birth, the doctor asked, "Who are you attending?" "Mrs. Ney," she said. They said no. She told me, "Look, the doctors say that I can't see you, that if I care for you, I'll be responsible for what might happen."
Porque dice el doctor que si yo te atiendo, soy responsable a lo que vaya a pasar.
Ney had to give birth without the assistance of her midwife. But first she had to be examined at her local health clinic. Then she had to drive to the hospital she was assigned to. Once there, the pain was so extreme that she couldn't walk. There was no time to spare.
Y en Cagua me pasaron con en la clínica para que me hagan un chequeo.
I made it to Cagua to get checked. And they said I was about to give birth. And there, my daughter was born. She was born normal. 6 normal births. I didn't have complications. I didn't have anything.
No tuve complicaciones. No tuve nada.
Many rural indigenous women receiving Prospera support are assigned to deliver their children in hospitals that are often over an hour away.
Como por ejemplo la comunidad de Chanchichimilá.
For example, in the community of Chanchichimilá, they don't have access to a clinic in the community. It doesn't exist. They only have a center with a health worker. So when a woman is about to give birth, the child doesn't say, "Here I come." No, it's a moment where it will just come. So there isn't adequate attention where they have control. They have to go from Chanchichimilá to Chiquinzonot, where they perform an examination. From there, they are sent to Valladolid. So there's the issue of the mother's life being at risk, the child.
Está en riesgo la vida de la mamá, del hijo.
That's Mijna Araceli. She's Ney's daughter-in-law, and she established the project Safe Maternity for the indigenous population in East Yucatan, after witnessing numerous cases of medical negligence of pregnant women in their community. This negligence and mistreatment of women is known as obstetric violence. It includes being verbally abused, forcibly examined, and coerced into surgery and permanent birth control.
¿Existe mucha violencia obstétrica?
There's a lot of obstetric violence, and often women from indigenous communities don't recognize it. One can tell them anything and it will be accepted as normal, when in reality you're violating her rights, and then in other circumstances, there's maternal mortality.
Because of this, Mirna holds workshops with women and youth so that they can take control of their sexual and reproductive rights. While Seguro Popular, Mexico's universal healthcare system, and Prospera are supposed to be a safety net for the poor, there aren't enough doctors, beds, or hospitals to provide adequate care.
Y en ocasiones ha habido muertes.
On occasion, there have been deaths in the community and in other communities because there isn't rapid transportation to get them out. In the centers, they have equipment, but not to give birth.
Pero no el equipo para atender.
And though it's more costly for the government to perform a cesarean than a vaginal birth, hospitals have to perform births quickly, and the option is often a cesarean, tripling the risk of death or illness for the mother and increasing the risk of the infant having respiratory problems. The Yucatan is among the 5 states in Mexico with the most C-sections. Ney's daughter also had to have a C-section that she believes could have been prevented.
I have a daughter that is mother to this boy. When I took her to the hospital, it was a Thursday evening. She had started having contractions. The doctor examined her and said she needed to dilate further so she should go home. "No, I'm not leaving," she said. She stayed, and on Saturday at about 7 in the morning, the doctor called me and said, "Ma'am, your daughter needs a cesarean. The baby is about to die. Its fluids have dried out." So I said, "Doctor, if I admitted my daughter on Thursday evening, why hasn't anything been done for her?" He just said, "We needed ultrasounds." I said, "Doctor, my daughter arrived with all of her paperwork, including the ultrasounds." He said, "You know what, ma'am? Please excuse me, because I'm just getting in. I don't know what happened with the other doctors." I said, "Fine, I'll sign the paperwork, but you need to act fast." 3 days after she gave birth, they released her from the hospital, and we went home to rest. I took her, but the same night that she was released from the hospital, she got a fever. She was burning up. I told my son-in-law, "My daughter isn't doing well. We need to take her back to the hospital. She shouldn't have a fever unless they treated her improperly." They said they had to clean her again, that they may have left some of the placenta behind. The next day she was released again, and that's this little boy that's grown now. Yes, that's Emiliano.
Y es cuando es este niño que ya está grandecito. Sí, es Emiliano.
Later in Ney's kitchen, the family gathers just before dinner.
Mother-in-law, do I give this to the chickens?
Yes, give that to the chickens.
Mirna chops radishes and other vegetables for the meal. She and her husband, Jose Antonio, live separately with their daughter, but Ney's kitchen is a central gathering place for the family. Jose Antonio tends to their daughter on the hammock. Jose Antonio says that Mirna's work has inspired change in the family. While Mirna was once expected to focus her attention solely on the care of her home and child, she now works outside of the home and has his support in that of the family. Like on many other occasions, Jose Antonio holds off on his work in the family's maíz field to drive Mirna to a workshop. He's a trained school teacher and says he sees the importance and change that her work is creating among women in the community, but especially among its youth. In a classroom in Chancón, a group of teens gather in a circle with Mirna. They have worked together to understand and identify gender issues and myths around sexuality in a space where they feel safe enough to speak openly about them. They share what they feel are advantages and disadvantages of being men or women in their community.
So you're telling me that a disadvantage is that men have a power over women. Why do you say that?
¿Por qué nos comentas esto?
Porque, como sabemos, hay violencia en la familia. because, like we have mentioned it, there is violence in some families. Women are seen as weaker in a relationship.
Okay, ahorita nos comenta algo muy interesante.
Okay, Diego is saying something very interesting. He's saying that one disadvantage is that women suffer violence. And we were talking about violence.
Midna continues going around the circle of teens, each student identifying issues that they weren't able to articulate or connect to their own experiences until now. She hopes that with this and future generations, the communities of Chancom, Shenla, and Chiquinzonot will come to recognize the human rights of indigenous women.
Making Contacts, Jasmine Lopez also produced this piece in collaboration with Project Luz student and reporter Karen Tenorio. Last year, Gabby Sei-Chow gave birth to her son when she was 19. When he was born, Baby Aiden made a bigger impact on Gabby's life and education than he may ever know. Radioactive's Walter Stanton has more.
Gabby Sei-Chow was in her first year of college when she heard those two dreaded words, "You're pregnant." At first, she was in denial, but there was no hiding it.
My mom knew straight away. She was really suspicious. At first, I tried to hide the pregnancy, so that didn't really help.
Gabby decided to keep her child, and 9 months later, she gave birth to her son, Aiden.
I did not get any sleep. Any parent who has had that 3 months of baby nightmarish crying all through the night, they'll understand.
Fortunately for Gabby, she isn't Aiden's only active parent. His father, Isaac, is very much present. He's worked hard to keep food on the table. Still, Gabby has trouble keeping up with her friends.
When you have a kid, making plans with friends can sometimes be a disappointment because sometimes they'll get sick and sometimes they'll just need you and you don't want to leave.
Goodbye!
Aiden was the most important part of her life now. Gabby went from having a wide circle of acquaintances to only a few of her closest friends.
Having a child, you have to think more about taking care of him. And just give up on all the silly ideas you have of going out and, like, having teenage fun, I guess.
Gabby had been attending college to major in English so she could become a teacher, but she had to postpone while taking care of Aiden. So she had a while to look at what she wanted to do and make some important choices.
And I completely changed from my original program of choice to something completely different.
She's decided to pursue an education in one of two fields, medicine or computer programming.
Having a child means that you have to have more job stability and you can't just run off on your own.
Gabby uses online resources to self-teach some of the important skills she'll need when she returns to college. One of her major shortfalls is math, an important component to code.
There's Khan Academy for math and science. There's Code Academy if you want to learn Java or HTML or any basic programming. Oh gosh, there are actually a lot of things that I do.
What keeps you going?
The idea of a better future. That's really all you can hope for your kids, to have them mature and follow their dreams.
Can I borrow?
Before she had Aiden, Gabby's dream was to teach foreign languages.
In Japan, English is a foreign language, and in America, Japanese would be a foreign language, so learn Japanese and teach one or the other. That was my goal.
She still dreams of visiting Japan, but now Aiden is part of the dream.
You gotta eat all that's on the spoon.
Gabby feels like sometimes she isn't as good at parenting as other people are, but she's trying.
I have a lot of friends on Facebook who are having their kids right now and who are taking care of them. They're doing all of these neat things. They're doing crafts and they're cooking. It makes me a little envious, and all I can do is just mimic that.
Since our interview, Gabby has been hired as a cashier at a home improvement store. It's a small step, but she's proud.
Everybody did something to help me and Aiden in some way. I've gotten so much support. It's really, I need to learn to stand on my own feet. As much support as you can get, you can only get help when you can help yourself.
Yummy. You're such a good boy.
Gabby plans to return to college next year when Aiden is 2. For Radioactive, I'm Walter Stanton.
Walter Stanton produced that story as part of Radioactive Youth Media in Seattle. Learn more at kuow.org/radioactive. We now head to Minneapolis, where the Prairie Fire Lady Choir has more than 50 volunteer singers. The all-female group sings everything from Metallica to Prince and performs at record stores, zombie pub crawls, and protests. Rather than employing an artistic director, the choir uses consensus decision-making to guide its collective musical vision. KFAI's Ryan Dawes brings us the story.
Prairie Fire Lady Choir is a dream. It is a fantasy of bringing together voices that never would have met and stretched our own skills in ways that we never thought possible. My name is Annette Skibout. I am a tenor 2, also a bass in the section, and I've been singing in the choir since day one. I was at the first rehearsal. There's something really powerful about the energy of women, and I think especially being involved in this group and some other groups that are exclusively women, there's a different process. I think there's a different hierarchy that I think if there were men involved, we would have probably a very different structure. Well, I think one of the things we've been practicing doing is consensus decision making and figuring out what that looks like. So how can we work as a group to make decisions about what we all want to be a part of and to come to an agreement, whether or not we agree with it completely, but at least there's some kind of democratic process, and then we can move forward and try to have a sound that is a collective vision.
Open pit barbecue sauce. Open pit barbecue sauce.
My name's Heidi Van Dixhorn, and I'm an Alto 1, and I've been with the choir for 4 years now. I like it because it's egalitarian. I mean, it's more so than having one person just decide, because music is so subjective. I don't know what would happen. I would have to see what would happen if guys became a part of the choir. This just fits and feels right. It's like it's a very powerful thing. And so it can be political. It can be feminist driven in some ways when you look at it, because it's, you know, don't mess with us. We're 50 strong. You know, like, we walk in and we command a space and it feels good.
I'm Dresden Jones. I'm an Alto 2, and this is my second season with the choir. I just think that we're unique in the sense that we sing Jeremy Messersmith. We sing original songs. We sing The Replacements. We sing Metallica. I mean, we really do a lot.
We belong to the light. We belong to the thunder.
Anytime you get a group of women who can pull something like this off and have it sound beautiful and have us be where we're supposed to be when we're supposed to be there, I mean, I'm really impressed with us, and we are all committed to making sure that we keep moving forward and kicking ass. Probably can't say ass, but
that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. Percent is spelled out. This week's show is number 1365.